Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
There are lakes all across Texas. Maybe you're headed to one this long holiday weekend. But there's only one lake surrounded by immense cypress trees and green Spanish moss that has an outsized reputation. Caddo Lake. Perhaps you've heard it's the only, quote, natural lake in Texas. Although that might not be true. You could ask folks who live nearby in uncertain Texas, but they might not be sure either. The Caddo Indian legend says the lake was formed by an earthquake caused by a chief's failure to obey the Great Spirit. Another version says the lake is the result of a logjam. In Texas, Caddo Lake is not the only body of water shrouded in mystery. Every lake in Texas has a story, even the unnatural ones. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're turning to a water expert to get to the bottom of Texas lakes and perhaps arm you with a story or two to share next time you're by the water. Andrew Sansom is the executive director of the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University in San Marcos. He joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you very much for having me.
So, Andrew, I'm not originally from Texas, but when I first got here, I heard that there were no natural lakes in the state. Is that true?
Actually, I think that contrary to popular legend, there are probably two which could be described as natural lakes. One, as you mentioned, is Caddo Lake, which was formed by a log jam. The log jam was blasted out by Captain Shreve, for whom Shreveport is named, in an attempt to get navigation up to Jefferson, the little town on the shores of Caddo. So today, Caddo actually has a very low, like 3-foot dam at the lower end, which is replaces the log jam and holds the water in place. And interestingly enough, probably the most interesting thing about Caddo is that because of that peculiar way that it was formed, the bottom of the lake, at least on the Texas side, was traditionally in private ownership, which you don't find in any other lake in the state. And the way we discovered that back in the early 1990s was that they began to actually cut the cypress trees for timber. And so we actually ended up buying most of the lake bottom in Caddo Lake during the 1990s with the support of Singer Don Henley, who lives there in Dallas, and former Governor Ann Richards, in order to preserve the cypress forest. The second lake, which is rarely mentioned, but which I believe also has natural origins, is Eagle Lake, which is southwest of Houston, just south of the town of Columbus, and it's in the lower Colorado River basin. And like Caddo, it has been improved, I guess you'd say, over the years, because it was traditionally used for the irrigation of the rice fields around the lower Colorado River, but there was clearly a lake there which would have been probably smaller than the current Eagle Lake, but it was formed by natural causes. So my feeling is that there are two lakes in Texas which could actually be described as a natural. One is Caddo and the other is Eagle Lake.
Okay, interesting. Good to know. I had never heard about the Eagle Lake one. Still, with two major lakes being natural, there are tons that are not natural or that are man-made, at least, in Texas. Why are there so many that are man-made lakes in this state?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. First and foremost, when Texas experienced between the years of about 1947 and 1957, what we call the drought of record, which means as bad as it's ever going to get. In fact, it is still the worst drought in the recorded history of the state. And so after that drought, Texans went on a absolute determined binge to make sure that if it ever happened again, there would be plenty of water for our citizens. And so there was a tremendous surge in the construction of reservoirs in response to the drought of the 1950s. Another reason is that Texas is a geography which is characterized by climatic extremes, both drought and flooding. Hmm. And in the Colorado River particularly, the flooding has been over the years catastrophic. And so the Highland Lakes, which are above the city of Austin and where Austin gets its water, were largely built for flood control purposes to stop the flooding that had repeatedly hammered Austin and cities below. So the second reason was flood control.
And yeah, I think Possum Kingdom was built during that. This is closer to Dallas, north of Dallas.
Correct. But Possum Kingdom is a very good example of that. Then the third primary reason is for cooling waters for power plants. Many of our biggest reservoirs were built in association with plants that produce electricity for our major cities. And so between the drought response, flood control, and power generation, or power cooling and generation, those were the primary reasons that we built so many lakes and reservoirs in the state. And the neat thing about it is that they've provided plenty of other side benefits which were not their primary purpose. First among those is recreation. Texas is generally thought to have the best bass fishing in the United States, and it's because of all these lakes. Almost all of them have parks of one kind or another on them. Many of our most popular state parks, like Lake Ray Roberts and others, were built, Lake Louisville, were built on the shores of lakes which were actually constructed for other purposes. And then finally, many of our lakes have very, very popular and successful residential subdivisions on them. And so they clearly have provided benefits beyond what their original purpose was when they were constructed.
Now, a quick sort of word terminology question. What is the difference between a reservoir and a lake? And people seem to use those interchangeably.
Well, first of all, it's not incorrect to use it interchangeably. There's no real reason not to. But I think you would normally think of a reservoir as a body of water which had actually been constructed or artificially created, although sometimes you see that term referring to other repositories of water or even other substances. But generally, I think the terminology relates to lake is a broader term which takes in both artificial and natural bodies of water, whereas reservoir is normally referred to as a body of water which was constructed by means of a dam.
Got it. Which in the case of Texas is the majority, right?
Correct.
So you just mentioned that a lot of Texas lakes are known for great fishing, for great bass fishing. How are they stocked with fish?
Well, that's an absolutely wonderful question. Texas has, in my judgment, the most aggressive research and development program for freshwater fisheries in the United States. One of the most spectacular venues that people who are interested in bass fishing should visit is the Texas Freshwater Fisheries Center, which is located at Athens and is on Lake Athens. And there's nothing like it anywhere else in the United States. And what they do there is they have research facilities into largemouth bass. They have visitation so that people can go and see various aquaria which represent the freshwater systems of the state. And then they have venues where children are actually taught to fish. But the key to the whole program is a effort called Operation Share Lunker. And Lunker is normally used to describe a large bass. And so what happens is that if you catch a bass on one of Texas lakes that's over 12 pounds, you can call no matter where you are in the state, you can call the Texas Freshwater Fisheries Center, and they will send what it resembles an ambulance to the site. They'll take the fish live, they take it back to Athens, and they put it into the breeding program.
Oh, wow.
So that it then breeds fish of a larger than normal size. And so that's one of the reasons why we have produced such huge largemouth bass in our lakes and reservoirs.
Do they pay you anything for it, or you're just doing the right
thing?
No,
they give you an award. It's a very sought after honor to be able to to contribute a fish to Lone Star Lunker. And sometimes they'll actually call you when they're done with it, and you can take it back and release it yourself.
Okay. Well, I did. I was looking online, actually, to see the record-setting catches recently, and I saw a headline that caught my eye. It said, record-setting bass caught in Texas with a McDonald's nugget.
Oh, funny.
And I was thinking, I don't know if that's the right strategy, but this one weighed 11 pounds, so not quite up to the minimum for that award.
Yeah. No, not at all. And, I think our record bass are somewhere up around 20 to 22 pounds.
Okay.
So the interesting thing about the McDonald's nugget is that these big bass are very aggressive. And I actually caught one time many years ago that had a half-digested mouse in its stomach. And one of the primary lures for large bass, it is a lure which resembles a mouse. I heard a story one time from a county commissioner in the Greenville area who told me that he had actually observed a bass catch a bird. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but he swore that he had actually seen a bass leap out of the water and capture a small bird that was perched in the grass adjacent to the lake.
Wow.
So they're very aggressive.
I will not be putting my finger out there above the water.
Exactly.
So what's involved in maintaining the correct environment for the bass in the water?
Well, I think the main thing, and once again, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Freshwater Fisheries managers are the best at it in the United States. Probably some of the key things have to do with managing the vegetation and the lake. This has become an increasingly challenging activity simply because of the encroachment of exotic vegetation that comes from other places. The most likely source is aquarium plants, because people think that, when their kids get bored with their aquarium, that the thing to do is just dump it in a lake. Well, oftentimes what happens when that occurs is that exotic and invasive species like hydrilla or giant salvinia or others get started in the lake. Mm. You mentioned Caddo. Caddo is struggling mightily with an invasive plant called giant salvinia,
I'm sorry to interrupt you real quick, but we're going to have to take a break. Let's talk about that invasive species and a different invasive species, zebra mussels, in Texas lakes when we come back from a break. You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. And you can join the conversation about lakes. Call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can pursue their passion. You can study social justice and build activism skills with fall courses like The Black Struggle for Freedom. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This month, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department warned people in central Texas about an invasive species that threatens lakes. It latches onto boats and rocks and sucks the nutrients out of water. The zebra mussel. This hour, we're talking about Texas lakes, how they formed, how we also formed them, and the threats they face with Andrew Sansom. He's executive director of the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University in San Marcos. Andrew, before the break, you mentioned another invasive species, a plant in Caddo Lake. Let's talk about that before we get to zebra mussels.
Lauren, the biggest, at least heretofore, before the zebra mussel arrived in Texas, the biggest invasive issues that we face in our lakes have to do with invasive plants. And as I mentioned, oftentimes their origin is from discarded aquaria that people are simply tired of maintaining, and so they dump the water in the lake. The worst one is called giant salvinia, which is aptly named because it can completely choke a lake. It grows so thick that it looks like you can walk across the lake, and it can grow as rapidly as a foot a day. And because it is exotic, there's no natural control. And so if you wanted to list the problems associated with maintaining our lakes in Texas, exotic species, in my mind, would go at the very top of the list.
So is there anything to do? What measures have people taken in Caddo Lake or other places?
There's
for the
really only two measures. One is the use of herbicides, which of course is not ideal because they're not necessarily selective, and so they end up killing other plants as well. They're also, they just have unintended consequences. Like, you know, you see these commercials for drugs on TV where the majority of the commercial is telling the bad things that could happen with the drug. We're using herbicides in our lakes is similar to that. The other control, which has become much more acceptable than 20 years ago, is the use of what are called triploid grass carp. A carp is a vegetarian fish from Asia, which the problem was when they were first introduced over here is that like other invasive species, they'd get out of control and they would virtually eat up everything in the lake, and that destroys the habitat and everything else. What we do now is there's a form of carp which is called triploid, which means that it has an extra chromosome and it can't breed. And so you can by permit, you can put triploid glass carp in lakes and not expect them to multiply so dramatically that they destroy all of the vegetation in the lake. So it's a form of control. And that typically is the most benign way to deal with invasive plants in the water.
You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. Or you can email think@kera.org with your questions or comments about lakes. Let's go to the phones now. Daniel is calling from San Marcos. Hi, Daniel. How's it going?
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show, guys. I used to work for the Ocarina Meadow Center. I used to remove invasive species of hydrilla because they were outcompeting the wild rice. And recently there was a case of the removal of Case Dam on the San Marcos River. And I kind of wanted to hear your speaker's thoughts on it.
All right. Thanks,
Well, first Andrew. Of all, Daniel, I would like to thank you for your work in removing invasive species from Spring Lake in the upper San Marcos River. That's one of the most, I should have mentioned to Lauren, it's one that doesn't have a whole lot of application in other places, but much of the invasive hydrilla, particularly in Spring Lake there on the Texas State University campus, was removed plant by volunteer divers. And like I say, that would be very difficult to do in other situations,
wow.
But it was very successful in Spring Lake. With respect to Capes Dam, that is a raging controversy in San Marcos. And And I have to say that I've tried to stay out of it except to accept the judgment of the scientists involved, which is that the best thing for the endangered species in the upper San Marcos River would be for the remnants of the dam, which is in bad disrepair, to be removed. One interesting connection that I have with that site is that many years ago I acquired called the spillway or the raceway from the Stokes family and created a city park in San Marcos. And I'd like to find a way to have that historic feature preserved, but I haven't seen a persuasive argument that would justify either the huge cost of restoring the dam or that it would be better for the endangered species in the river if the dam were removed.
Andrew, let's talk about zebra mussels, because this is on a lot of people's minds. There was a warning that zebra mussels have infested many of Texas lakes. How big of a threat and a problem is this?
Well, Lauren, in my mind, it's one of the scariest things that has happened in my many years of dealing with these issues. And the thing that frightens me most about it is that I'm sure you're aware that it was actually detected within the last week or so in Lake Travis, which is just north of Austin.
Yeah.
The zebra mussel is an organism which previously was only known in very cold environments. In fact, the first place that it showed up in the United States was in the Great Lakes. And what is apparently happening is that it's morphing or evolving so that it is continuously moving further south. The first detection of zebra mussels in Texas was in Lake Texoma, and now, you know, it's appearing a couple of hundred miles south in Lake Travis. And so presumably that if we can't find a way to get a handle on it or control its spread, it could infest virtually every lake in the state.
And what is it that the zebra mussels do that is so dangerous to the lakes?
Well, the most onerous thing that they do is that they are so prolific that they can completely cover boat motors. They can move into the pipes that are used to extract water from the lakes for industrial cooling towers or city municipal water supplies. They can completely block those kind of distribution systems. From a recreational standpoint, their little shells are very sharp, and so children can actually cut their feet or be injured by walking on them. But the main problem with them is that they're so prolific that they block up important water infrastructure and boat motors and other devices that depend on having a clear flow of water through them.
This morning on Texas Standard, the host David Brown spoke with the Texas Department of Parks and Wildlife Aquatic Invasive Species team lead. Her name is Monica McGarity. Let's listen to a clip from that.
Once they're in a lake, there's virtually nothing that can be done other than to try to minimize the impacts. What folks can do is clean, drain, and dry their boats. Every time you take a boat on a waterway, there's potential that residual water that's left in the boat can be carrying zebra mussel larvae. And if you go to a new lake, you can carry those with you. Folks need to check their anchors, check all of their gear, make sure that they haven't picked up any mussel. They're sneaky. You might not see them. And that's something that we hear from folks frequently, that they're devastated to find out that they might be moving these things around without knowing it.
Andrew, do those suggestions sound like enough? Is there anything else people can do besides cleaning their boat and really keeping track of that?
Not much. And like Monica, and I heard the interview, and I know that there are plenty of examples across the United States where people are required to basically almost sterilize their boats before they're placed in other waters. This is particularly true in the West, where you can move diseases from one stream or another. But I just can't stress enough how important it is that if you own a recreational boat and you're going to move it from one lake to another in Texas, that you dry it out, you wash it off, and you carefully inspect it to determine whether or not, you know, you may be carrying one of these things, because they explode. Once they move to another body of water, they are out of control.
And does washing with water, is that enough, or do you need to use something stronger?
No, generally not. I think the main thing is it is also to dry it.
Got it. All right. You can join the conversation about lakes in Texas. Call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go to Nick, who's calling from Dallas. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to ask about the zebra mussels and if the fact that there are so many man-made lakes with, you know, dams and equipment, if that is something that helps stop the spread, or does it worsen the spread, or does it not make a difference?
Well, that's a kind of a neat perspective. What I would say is that it probably neither contributes nor reduces the spread, but what it does is that it provides the opportunity for more populations to take hold in Texas. And because, as I mentioned early in the show, that many of these lakes were constructed for electrical generation, cooling towers, or municipal water supply, these lakes then provide the opportunity for zebra mussels to do a lot of damage because their primary impact is on water infrastructure.
That's an interesting point. Interesting question.
But that's a cool perspective.
Now, you're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman. My guest today is Andrew Sansom. He's a leading conservationist in Texas and executive director of the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University in San Marcos. Andrew, I'm curious about how zebra mussels could actually affect people who don't think they have anything to do with lakes, people who, say, have water bills.
Yeah, I think that's the what I was going to say before you prompted me, is that where we'll see it is in the price that we pay for water. It's going to be extremely expensive to replace or try to ream out, you know, water lines that, for example, conduct water from reservoirs into the city of Dallas or the city of Austin. And what that will do is inevitably raise the price of water, you know, to consumers. And so that will be the primary impact.
Let's go back.
If a person is not otherwise, you know, engaged in lake-based recreation or fishing or whatever. And by the way, while we're on the subject of fishing, one of the things that I have to tell you is, having heard that little interview on the Texas Standard with Monica McGarrity, is that all of the money that goes into the research and management of these fisheries in these lakes actually come from anglers who fish and buy fishing licenses. And so while the impact of some of these issues is on all Texans, the weight of the expenditures for the management of both our lakes and the species within them are borne by recreational fishermen.
That's a good point.
Fisher persons.
Fisher persons, exactly. Let's go back to the phones now. John is calling from Beaumont. Hi, John.
Hi. I just had a question about the actual detriment of zebra mussels. I'm originally from Chicago, and I remember when they
exactly
came through. Yeah, and the major detriment we had, and that was explained to us, was it made the drinking water taste funny. And it's explained that they are such good filter feeders that they'll take out a lot of the plankton from the water. They'll make it more clear. Sunlight gets deeper. You get more algae and more plant growth. Then you have so much more plant growth that, one, there's some intake into the water treatment plants, and also when those plants die, they taste a little funny. I was just wondering, that sounds like the real detriment to it is that it makes drinking water taste worse, but there might actually be some recreational benefit that it makes the water in Lake Travis more clear.
Well, I would say that that's possible, but it's far outweighed by the negative effects.
The negative effects of what you were describing in terms
right.
of the engines right. and the danger and the clogging of pipelines.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Interesting, though. I guess there's always it's
always
about
always two sides
yeah,
to
always
a story.
Weighing the positives and the negatives as well. Let's pick up another caller from Houston. Tony's calling from Houston. Hey, Tony, how's it going?
Yes, good. I have a small pond, which I got a permit a couple of years ago for the grass carp.
Right.
That doesn't seem to be working. The problem's gotten worse. I transferred them in August. I wonder if the heat might have been too much and they expired.
I think that's highly probable.
Mm. Also, you got to be careful when you do it.
Yeah.
We did wait a little bit, and it was a little better than when I first went for them. But I guess I just reapply for a permit and explain the circumstances.
That's what I would do.
And Tony, were you using those carp because what was for excessive growth of the salvinia or for some other invasive plant?
I don't believe they're invasive plants, but the grass is pretty bad all around the edge, and it's getting towards the middle, and I'd like to have it not completely clear, but better.
Tony, there's going to be an office near you of the Inland Fisheries Division at Texas Parks and Wildlife, and those guys are, you know, they're customer oriented, so they know that, you know, that you're one of the people that helps pay their bills, and so they will give you, they might not come out to your site, but they'll certainly give you free advice, mm-hmm. and you might even get one of them to come out, and you wouldn't have to pay for it. So look for Parks and Wildlife's Inland Fisheries Division, and they'll be able to answer your questions.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We're talking with Andrew Sansom. He's Executive Director of the Meadow Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And coming up, we'll talk a little bit about water supply in Texas, as well as tips for summer swimming spots.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for working adults interested in human-centered leadership. You can take courses this fall like Personhood in the Age of Corporate Enterprise. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about the indispensable, sometimes unnatural, lakes of Texas. Our guest is Andrew Sansom. He's Executive Director of the Meadow Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University in San Marcos. Andrew, cities across Texas are growing at extraordinary rates. By some estimates, Dallas-Fort Worth's population is expected to rise by more than 50% by 2040. Which would put the total population at almost 11 million. Is there enough water for this size population?
So, Lauren, here would be what I would say is the principal takeaway of the hour that we've spent together. Texas is going to have twice as many people in the next 50 years, and yet we've already given permission for more water to be withdrawn from most of our rivers than is actually in them, such that if all the water rights that have been issued for Texas rivers were actually used, many of them would be dry today, and yet we've got to find water for twice as many people in the next half century. So this is the defining natural resource issue for the next generation in Texas, and it will control both the quality of our environment and our quality of life in the years ahead, but also our ability to continue to economically prosper.
Yeah, well, it's huge. And there's,
it is huge.
There's some projects I've heard about. There was one called the Integrated Pipeline Project that's supposed to help provide water for North Texas. What's the plan with that?
Well, historically, literally going back to the 1930s, there have been schemes, and I don't use that in a negative sense, but there have been proposals to move water westward. And, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise that that has been a continual conversation when you have 60 inches of rainfall in the eastern part of the state and 10 inches of rainfall in the far western part of the state. And so as you progressively move westward, the rainwater is decreased, but that's where the population growth is. The population growth is literally along the I-35 and I-45 corridors. And so I believe that ultimately, certainly in your lifetime, if not mine, that there will be large-scale movement of water across the state to the west, but it is tremendously controversial, and it has never been successful, primarily because people are frightened with the idea of moving water away from where they are to other places. It's just it's a frightening prospect. And, you know, when we talk about pollution and garbage and things, the terminology is not in my backyard. This is not out of my backyard. There's just always opposition for water moving out of a local area or geography. Probably the first place that you're going to see it in any scale is from the counties that are east of Austin and San Antonio toward the I-35 corridor between, say, Georgetown and San Antonio. And I think that'll be the first area where you're seeing groundwater actually pumped in large amounts and then pipe westward to where the population is.
But of course, it's controversial on a lot of levels, but you also have to use land that's been to build the pipeline, right? That's been in families for generations or been...
That's a really good point, because both in the case of projects like pipelines, but also reservoirs themselves, one of the things that makes that construction of that kind of infrastructure so much more difficult than it was, say, 30 or 40 years ago, is because the opposition to eminent domain has never been greater in Texas. There's a new generation of landowners, many of whom are on the land for recreational reasons. They're affluent, they're politically influential, and they fight like you know what, when the prospect for their land to be condemned becomes a reality. And so it's going to be hard. A real good example of that is, you know, there's been tremendous opposition to actually building a high-speed rail, which would connect the major cities. And the opposition to it is largely from people who oppose eminent domain.
So what other solutions are there for providing water for not just North Texas, but lots of places that in the next 50 years are going to need double?
Well, I would say there's three really promising ones, at least. The first and most important one is that we have to become more efficient. The cities of San Antonio and El Paso have lowered their consumption of water by 40% per capita, and they're still exploding economically. San Antonio has added like 1.5 million citizens over the last 15 years or so, and yet its overall consumption of water has been flat. So there are still cities in Texas where the per capita consumption of water is still increasing, and that's unacceptable going forward. So increased efficiency is the first solution. The second is, instead of building these large surface reservoirs that we've depended on in the past, there's a new and very exciting technology which is called aquifer storage and retrieval, where in times of excess, meaning floods and high rainfall and surplus water, it's actually pumped back into the aquifers in the ground. And what that does is it doesn't require the fights that you get into over eminent domain or environmental problems or other things, and it doesn't evaporate. Any new reservoir that would be built west of I-35 in Texas would lose more in evaporation than it would actually produce. So storing the water in the ground, as much as anything else, inhibits or actually prohibits evaporation. And then finally, one of the coolest ones is we have an immense supply in Texas of what is called brackish groundwater. And that means the water is somewhat salty, not anything like the Gulf of Mexico, but it is saline. Well, number one, it costs less to desalinate it because it's not as saline as Gulf seawater. And number two, it's closer to where the customers are. And so you're now seeing brackish desal plants go in. There's a huge one in El Paso. There's one going in San Antonio. There's one in the Valley. And so I think the increased efficiency, aquifer storage and retrieval, and brackish desalination present some of the most exciting prospects.
Well, those are ones I hadn't heard about the last two, so that's interesting. And the desalination plants, like you said, I guess if you don't have to take too much salt out of it, it's easier to do. It's not as much of a job.
Well, you know, we potentially, in my judgment, once again, in your lifetime, if not mine, we will be deriving water from the Gulf of Mexico. But just think about this. If you have to spend the energy to desalinate the water in the first place, which is very energy intensive, and then pump it upstream to Houston or Dallas or Austin, then you've expended enormous amounts of energy, and we're just not yet prepared to pay the cost of water that kind of technology would require.
Let's go to the phones. Solomon is calling from Dallas. Hi there.
Hi. You were just talking about that brackish water, but there's like natural lakes in South Texas called Resacas that they're close to the Gulf of Mexico, and like they surface like 10, 20, 30 miles inside land. And there's I've been fishing in them, and they fish for a bass. And another thing I wanted to say is California holds record for largemouth bass. Am I right?
Yes, sir.
Uh-oh, bringing in the competition.
Also Florida. We have competition from both California and Florida.
All right. Thanks, Solomon. Yeah, those resacas. What are those?
The resaca is what we call in other parts of the state like an oxbow lake. They're typically formed from meanders of the Rio Grande, and as it changes course, it moves away, but yet the lake is still left. So I would call them resaca is the same as an oxbow lake. It's a meander of the Rio Grande.
So when people ask you for tips, Andrew, on summer swimming spots, maybe lesser known, or at least until now you give it away, lesser known summer spots to go and enjoy the lakes around Texas, what's top on your list?
Well, you know, the most iconic swimming holes are in the Hill Country because of the springs. Mm. And what we're experiencing here and the best advice I could give people who want to come and swim in the springs in the Hill Country is you got to make reservations now. You know, two real good examples are Hamilton Pool, which is west of Austin, which is a county park, and then the Blue Hole Park, which is in the village of Wimberley, which is west of San Marcos. And in both cases, they basically have an excess of people by about 9 o'clock in the morning. And so they're now taking reservations and will through the summer. So the one piece of advice would be that if you're thinking about coming to the Hill Country to hit some of our most iconic and beloved water holes, you need to check first because oftentimes you'll show up and they won't let you in.
And Hamilton,
That's kind of neat that people have that love them so much, but on the other hand, it's become a significant problem.
Hamilton Pool, I actually haven't been there, but I've seen photos. It looks amazing. Like you're in these sort of jade colored waterfalls there. So you're saying you can make reservations?
You have to.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
it's
a gorgeous place, and I couldn't recommend it more highly. Sometime when you're down this way to visit, because it is a absolutely stunningly beautiful place.
How about for fishing? What lakes do you like to go to? I don't know if you fish yourself or which ones you just know have good fishing this time of year.
Well, of course, the most legendary bass fishing lake in Texas, and really one of the top ones in the United States, is Lake Fork, which is east of Dallas. Lake Fork is a cool lake. Caddo is interesting because it has a high diversity of fish. I mean, there's a number of different native species there, so you're not just catching largemouth bass. Further south, a lake that has typically been very productive is Choke Canyon, which is north of Corpus Christi. One of the ones that I've been hearing lately that is really caught fire is Lake Buchanan, which is north of Austin. When we were talking about vegetation before, it's important to understand that some level of vegetation is important because it provides the nutrients for the fish. And what I would look for, if I wanted to, you know, to make some effort to catch fish, would be a lake where during the drought of 2011, the lake was way down so that trees and things actually grew up in it while it was down, and now it's full again. And what that does is typically the best fishing is when a lake is in its early stages of filling up, or when it's been low enough that vegetation has grown into it and then it fills again, because that provides a tremendous source of nutrients for the fish. So look for a lake that almost went dry in 2011 and then came back up.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman. My guest today is Andrew Sansom. He's a leading conservationist in Texas and executive director of the Meadow Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University. So did you grow up fishing or swimming in Texas
yes,
lakes?
Yes. Lauren, I grew up and learned to fish from my maternal grandmother, who was a farm woman. She lived on a dairy farm. And she went down every single day with a cane pole and fished in a farm pond on her lake. And she taught me how to fish. So I fished from a very early age. And I was a lifeguard in a swimming pool. So I've spent a good part of my life around the water recreationally.
What's your greatest hope, having spent so much time around the water in Texas? I know there are different threats we talked about, the zebra mussels, invasive species, and of course, drought is always a concern. What do you hope for Texas lakes in the next 10 years? What do you hope happens?
I think that my hope is also the one thing that all of us can do. No matter what walk of life we're in or whatever, everyone should take the time during the course of a year to introduce a child to recreation in the water, whether it's swimming or fishing or kayaking or water skiing or any one of the number of things that you can do, because our children are growing up mainly in our major urban centers now, and they're not getting exposed to the outdoors as I was as a child. And we have to have kids understand that water is fun, but it's also something that they have to take responsibility for. And one of the best places to help them learn that is at the Edwin Cox Freshwater Fishery Center in Athens.
Oh, great suggestion. Andrew Sansom, it was really great talking with you. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, and pray for rain.
All right. Andrew Sansom is executive director of the Meadow Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University. I'm Lauren Silverman. Thanks for listening.